This is an ABC podcast.
Hi, I'm Linda Mottram. In this episode, the attacks in the Gulf of Oman and what they might mean for world trade, how technology is reshaping the world of war, and what awaits Julian Assange if he is extradited to the United States. Well, it was a day for recalling the great sweep of Bob Hawke's reform agenda for Australia, his capacity as both administrator and beloved man of the people, as dignitaries farewelled Australia's 23rd Prime Minister at an emotional and at times funny state funeral in Sydney. Political, business, union figures past and present, left and right, as well as family, joined in tributes in a packed concert hall of the Sydney Opera House. It's the place where Bob Hawke launched his 1983 federal election campaign before going on to win four elections. His longtime friend, one-time rival, Paul Keating, called him a five-star, 24-carat Prime Minister. On the steps outside of the Opera House, thousands came to pay their respects to the man that some were calling Australia's greatest Prime Minister. Let's let the day speak for itself.
I remember him being a wonderful uniting figure. Probably we've only had a couple of those since then, so yeah.
Can I ask why you've come today?
Just to pay respect. I think Bob Hawke and Paul Keating were an amazing part of Australia's history and, well, as the cliche, man of the people, you know.
We love Bob.
Why do you love Bob?
Because he's a great Australian and he cared about Australia and Australians.
I think Bob is just an icon. Could hold his own amongst the greats, but also was always working class and for the working people of Australia.
Australians all, let us rejoice for the life of Robert James Lee Hawke. Today I come to speak on behalf of a nation Bob Hawke loved and that deeply loved him in return. And as a Liberal, I'm honoured to acknowledge these achievements as I know others would be.
Bob Hawke was not towering physically, but somehow he seemed bigger than all of us. Do you know why I have credibility, he once asked? Because I don't exude morality.
Well, thank you, Albo. Albo, ScoMo, MO. It's a very Australian celebration, and this is a celebration.
Well, I guess here's Kimbo. I nagged Bob into taking the cabinet to sea for a meeting. The biggest ship, HMAS Stalwart. The Stalwart passed through the Sydney Heads and began to roll. The table started to move. It pinned the Prime Minister to the bulkhead. Then it retreated.
That night of the vote, he woke me, as promised, to say that he had done okay, but lost. And when I was puzzled, proceeded to explain the mechanics of DLP preferences to me. I was six.
He would open Australia. He would open Australia to the rest of the world. And he would do something for women and make their place better in this country. Was he inspirational? He was. His decision to allow 40,000 Chinese to stay in this country following Tiananmen Square.
Did you come here when he was Prime Minister?
Yeah. I got my own mortgage, everything very good, happy life here. I say thanks to the Hawke.
Bob Hawke is a great leader. He bring the bridge between the Australia and China, and he understand the importance of two great nations to work together.
We're just saying that there's something about being here in the present, on these steps, at this very special point.
Long live friendship among nations, and beyond all, long live love. Thank you.
Bob Hawke's wife, Blanche Dalpuget, at the end there, at today's celebration of the late Prime Minister Bob Hawke, who died last month, age 89. Isabel Rowe brought that together for you tonight. Well, the WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange is expected in court in London this evening, fighting a United States demand for his extradition to face espionage charges. Some fear if he is extradited, his fate before the particular court where he's charged is sealed. John Kiriakou is a former CIA agent who went on TV in the US in the early 2000s to publicly expose the US government's official torture program against terror detainees, and particularly to reveal extreme use of waterboarding and its failure to produce results. He eventually spent close to 2 years in jail and was tried in the same court Julian Assange would appear in if he is extradited. I asked John Kiriakou first about the appropriateness of the espionage charges.
The Espionage Act here in the United States was written in 1917 specifically to combat German saboteurs. It was never updated. And in fact, it's so old and so broad that it doesn't even mention the term classified information, because the classification system hadn't even been invented until the 1950s. It mentions only national defense information, and national defense information is not defined. Between 1917 and 2009, only three people, all Americans, were charged with espionage for speaking with the media. None of those people were convicted. And it's because the law was interpreted all the way up to the Circuit Court of Appeals level as being meant for foreign intelligence officers or people working on behalf of foreign intelligence officers. Julian hasn't worked for foreign intelligence officers, and I suspect that the Justice Department has bitten off a little more than it can chew.
Well, why do you say that? Because, I mean, they are on the cusp, really, of getting him, and there are these 17 counts, and you know very well how the court system works. So how do you see this playing out then?
Well, I think the problem that Julian has is that he's been charged in the Eastern District of Virginia, and that is the federal district that is the home of the CIA and the Defense Department. Almost every espionage case is brought there, and no national security defendant has ever won. No one has ever been acquitted in the Eastern District of Virginia. And so I believe when I say that the fix is probably in. With that said, if Julian does not take a plea and is convicted of even one of these counts of espionage, he would then be that rare person who has standing to appeal to the Supreme Court of the United States on the grounds that the Espionage Act is unconstitutionally broad. That argument has never been made before the Supreme Court. Now might be the time.
One of the claims that Julian Assange's critics make is that the work he's done and WikiLeaks have endangered lives with revelations they've made. Do you believe that to be true?
No, heavens no. That's a red herring that the Justice Department throws out in every single one of these cases. I even predicted before Julian was formally charged that the Justice Department would tell the media here in the States that he had put Americans' lives in danger. And sure enough, they said it, although they can't prove it. And they can't prove it because it never happened.
I mean, we are yet to see the British court process play out, of course. But
yes,
assuming Julian Assange is extradited and faces a court, he is certainly being pursued by the US authorities because he published, whether one believes he's a journalist or not. Does this break new ground for the US in terms of First Amendment press freedom protections there?
Without a doubt. Without a doubt, it does break new ground. And you can tell that by the way the mainstream media has done a 180-degree turn since Julian's arrest. MSNBC, one of the big cable news networks here, was staunchly in the anti-Julian camp until the day of his arrest. Similarly, the Washington Post, which is very neoliberal in its outlook and had been publishing editorials solidly opposed to Julian, saying that he wasn't even man enough to leave the embassy and face his charges, immediately turned and said, we all have to stand together to support Julian Assange because it's Julian Assange being the only person or the only thing that stands between national security journalists and prison sentences.
John Kiriakou, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Former CIA officer and whistleblower John Kiriakou speaking to me from Virginia. The US military has released a video it says shows Iran's Revolutionary Guard removing an unexploded limpet mine from the side of one of two oil tankers attacked in the Gulf of Oman. The overnight explosions on the Japanese-owned and Norwegian-owned ships are suspected Iranian mine attacks, the US says. The crews were forced to abandon ship. That left them adrift in waters between Gulf Arab states and Iran. The blunt message from US Central Command is that the United States has no interest in engaging in a new conflict in the Middle East, but that it will defend its interests. Now, BIMCO, the world's largest international shipping association, says tensions in the area are as high as it gets without being an actual armed conflict. David Taylor reports.
The US has deployed the aircraft carrier, the Abraham Lincoln, loaded with warplanes, to the Arabian Sea. It follows what the US describes are credible threats from Iran. Already on edge, news overnight of attacks on two oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman led to this news conference from the US Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo.
These unprovoked attacks present a clear threat to international peace and security, a blatant assault on the freedom of navigation, and an unacceptable campaign of escalating tension by Iran.
Iran has repeatedly denied being behind the attacks, but Mike Pompeo is already calling for other nations to get behind the US in the event of a conflict.
The United States will defend its forces, interests, and stand with our partners and allies to safeguard global commerce and regional stability. And we call upon all nations threatened by Iran's provocative acts to join us in that endeavour.
Saudi Arabia is supporting the US. Colonel al-Maliki saying the attacks represent a major escalation in Middle East tensions.
And there is a huge and, of course, there is escalation by the Iranian regime.
Japan is being careful with its language in response to the attack on its ship, but it's clear for now it's standing with the US. Yoshihide Suga is the Japanese Chief Cabinet Secretary.
We will work closely with the United States in regard to dealing with the current situation in the Middle East, including Iran. The path to easing tensions is difficult, but the Japanese government will work hard towards peace and stability in the Middle East.
The heightened tensions centre around Iran's nuclear ambitions. In 2018, the US pulled out of a landmark nuclear deal reached in 2015 that was aimed at curbing Iran's nuclear activities. The move was strongly criticised by a number of countries, including America's closest allies. President Donald Trump, though, dug in, tightening US sanctions on Iran, mainly targeting its oil sector. Mike Pompeo again.
On April 22nd, Iran promised the world that it would interrupt the flow of oil through the Strait of Hormuz. It is now working to execute on that promise.
Overnight, the price of crude oil spiked by around 4%. Iran's economy depends heavily on oil, but energy analysts say Saudi Arabia is more desperate to see the price of oil rise. Evan Lucas is the chief market strategist at InvestSmart.
I think you need to look at this in context of what's been going on over the last 3 to 4 years, not with just in isolation of the geopolitical issue that happened in the last 24 hours. This definitely has implications for what has been going on with Saudi Arabia as well and the tightness behind it. OPEC is not as sort of coherent as it once was. There has always been issues between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and that is also part of this whole idea in the fact that at the moment Saudi Arabia is very clearly trying to also pressure Iran since the Obama administration's release of their sanctions. We know the Trump administration's a little bit different in terms of its current negotiations, and there has been tariffs put back on them. However, it still is allowed to put oil into the market, and that in itself is also part of this conundrum.
For now, though, the US military is standing by and ready for conflict. Captain William Reed from the US Navy.
We are not looking for war. Our key mission is deterrence. We are trying to add stability. However, if the United States is attacked, if our interests are attacked, then we will respond with unrelenting force.
The European Union is calling for, quote, maximum restraint, while Russia says no one should jump to conclusions or use the incident to put pressure on Iran. In a statement, the Australian government says it strongly condemns the latest attacks on shipping in the Gulf of Oman, adding that it's following the matter closely, including through Australia's embassies in the region.
David Taylor with that report. You're listening to PM on the radio, on the app and on the podcast. I'm Linda Mottram. Ahead, 1 year since the start of the National Redress Scheme for survivors of institutional child sexual abuse, why have only 200 people received a payout? Well, Australia's Defence Force Chief has warned Australia is at risk of being subjected to non-violent tactics like cyber attacks and technologically empowered propaganda, unsettling new threats that fall short of a traditional military scenario. Angus Campbell raised the concerns, which are shared by other nations, at a conference in Canberra on the future of war. With about 80 billion things or objects set to be connected to the internet in coming years, and with more and more countries looking to dominate space, governments and militaries globally are grappling with the risks that they'll be used for menace. Political reporter Stephanie Boris reports.
Information is a powerful commodity and technology has made it more accessible.
Given our reliance on technology, it's hard to mute the war being waged on our news feeds and in our social media streams, in our pockets.
Nicole Matisse is an expert in preventing violent extremism, counter-terrorism and digital diplomacy. She says technology is the newest tool in political warfare.
This used to be a traditionally viewed civilian space. Al-Shabaab and then ISIS changed that. And we certainly can't put that genie back in its bottle now.
Propaganda and spreading mistruths to create fear is nothing new in the art of war, but the way in which it's carried out has changed. The days of leaflet drops from planes has now moved to the internet. Chief of the Defence Force is General Angus Campbell.
In a world that's becoming more connected, these activities range from information campaigns, cyber operations and theft of intellectual property to coercion and propaganda. Grey zone operations that subvert, erode and undermine.
Speaking at ASPE's War in 2025 conference, General Campbell warned non-violent tactics such as cyber attacks and propaganda have left nations like Australia exposed. A case in point, he says, the tactics used against Ukraine by Russia in 2014.
This masked warfare was a nod to Soviet-style disruption, but it was also accompanied by computer attacks, manipulation of social and mass media, collapse of the national financial system.
Dr. Malcolm Davis is a senior analyst in defence strategy and capability for ASPE. He says the attack on Ukraine gives us a taste of what is to come and Australia needs to be on high alert.
We need to recognise that the next war may not be against an Al-Qaeda or an Islamic State, it may be China or Russia.
Brigadier Stephen Beaumont works within the Information Warfare Division, set up in 2017 to help defend the military systems. He believes cyber attacks on Australian soil have been a wake-up call and says more is being done to ward off attacks.
The incidents of cyber incidents in Australia have helped force whole-of-government actions to get organised around things like that, threats like that.
But there is much more work to be done in this space, and it's not just about deciding how and when Australia can fight back. There's a severe shortage of cybersecurity experts, and a recent report suggested an extra 18,000 are needed by 2026. The federal government has been investing more money in the sector, but as technology continues to evolve at the rate of knots, it may be hard to keep up.
Stephanie Boris with that report. Well, watching the new web of threats coming down the pipeline, the US Army set up a Futures Command to address just those issues. General John Mike Murray is the commanding general of US Army Futures Command. He's in Australia for that war conference in Canberra that Steffi just reported on. I spoke to him first about a core idea for Futures Command, the idea of multi-domain operations.
We've always dealt with three warfighting domains, if you will, air, land, and sea. Cyber, we have been talking about for a long time, and the fifth domain is space. So it's really the convergence of effects across all five of those domains on a near-constant basis. So it's How do you converge all those to really present multiple dilemmas to your opponent?
What does it look like on the ground practically? I know some people have referred, for example, to the situation in Ukraine with the Russians, and some have suggested that the US was maybe outgunned by the Russians in that field. What were the Russians doing there that might help us to understand practically as laypeople what this new landscape looks like?
We watched what happened in the Ukraine and the ability to really converge air and ground, and in many cases, electronic warfare to drive certain units to certain means of communicating, which were then targeted. So that's a very simplistic example.
What were the Russians doing that was so surprising to Americans?
I think the effectiveness of what they were doing is what surprised us. Not necessarily what they were doing, but how effective they were at doing it.
What would you say is the greatest risk to democracies in the non-traditional realm? What are we not seeing that might be hitting us right now that we might in the very near future consider to be an act of war against us?
I think probably information operations, if that rings a bell with you. I think continued and probably greater attacks from a cyber standpoint. I think that's the non-traditional thing. Both of those are happening right now, but I think continued use of that and even more damaging use of the internet.
China is the other big question. Is China a major source of concern for you in this new landscape you're talking about?
Well, our national defense strategy gives us two focuses for the Army, Russia in the near term and China as a longer term. Not that we ever want to go to war with either one of them. The hope is to avoid war in all cases. It's the maintenance of international norms is what concerns us most presently. And then Russia and China have both undertaken a pretty significant military modernization effort. It goes back to your outranged, outgunned comment. And we don't think we're there yet, but we were going to get there if we didn't do something like modernize ourselves.
General Murray, thank you so much for speaking with PM tonight.
It's good talking to you, Linda.
General Mark Murray is the Commanding General of US Army Futures Command. July the 1st marks 1 year since the start of the National Redress Scheme for the survivors of institutional child sex abuse. Nearly 4,000 applications have been received, but fewer than 200 payments have been made. Applicants are despairing at the delays, and lawyers are urging the federal government to overhaul the scheme immediately. Samantha Donovan reports.
Victorian man Roy Janetsky applied for redress under the national scheme last July. His wife Rhonda applied in August. They're still waiting for their applications to be processed.
Every time I ring up, yes, you are a priority. Yes, it is in the works, but nothing happens. You just made wait. It's an overwhelming burden that we shouldn't have to carry. You know, no one cares. There was nothing about it in the election. Scott Morrison, he could put pressure out there, but he's just not interested.
The dissatisfaction with the redress scheme extends to the lawyers working on redress applications. No More is a national independent community legal service. It's funded by the federal government to advise abuse survivors. Warren Strange is its executive officer.
There are some significant concerns around the design of the scheme and how it operates. And some of the key issues relate to the cap or the maximum amount of redress that people can obtain, their access to counselling, and things like their eligibility to apply in the first place.
In April, a parliamentary committee report made 29 recommendations to improve the operation of the scheme. They include increasing the maximum payment to $200,000, as the Royal Commission had recommended, that the amount of counselling available to survivors under the scheme be increased, and that a new assessment framework that's closer to the Royal Commission's proposal be developed. Warren Strange acknowledges many redress applicants aren't happy with the existing framework.
Where they were subjected to abuse that didn't involve penetration but still involved contact, and it happened repeatedly across periods of years and impacted them very, very adversely, that isn't recognised in a proper way under this assessment matrix.
The Parliamentary Committee also recommended that governments pressure institutions to join the scheme, and if they don't, punish them by suspending their tax concessions and charitable status. Warren Strange.
We saw a very cogent example of that recently. There was a particular institution in Tasmania involved in foster care that had indicated it was not going to join the redress scheme. The Tasmanian state government then indicated that if any institution facing significant liability for child abuse claims did not participate in the scheme, that the state government would look at withdrawing their funding. And that very quickly led to an about-face and a decision that that institution would participate.
South Australian Senator Anne Rustin now has oversight of the National Redress Scheme as the new Minister for Families and Social Services. A spokeswoman for the Department of Social Services has told PM,
"The government is carefully considering the Joint Select Committee's report and all of the recommendations. Any significant changes to the scheme must be agreed to by the state and territory ministers responsible for redress."
Improvements to the scheme can't come soon enough for applicants like Rhonda Janetsky.
I'm back to having the nightmares. It's just hanging over your head all the time. I just want it to end.
Redress scheme applicant Rhonda Janetsky. Samantha Donovan with that report. The world is on track to warm by 2 degrees Celsius by 2060, but climate change scientists have had mixed theories on how that might change the severity and paths of tropical cyclones. This week at a major meteorological conference in Darwin, scientists say they're getting closer to answers. Amelia Turzon reports.
Cyclone Tracy, officially called a severe tropical cyclone with hurricane-force winds, is heading towards the city.
45 years ago, Cyclone Tracy flattened Darwin, killing more than 70 people and destroying 70% of the city's infrastructure.
You've got a situation here where there's no power, no running water.
And it was in this same city that this week scientists from around the world gathered for a climate convention, with tropical cyclones one of the hot topics. Michael Montgomery from the Naval Postgraduate School in California studies what cyclones might do globally under climate change.
On the one hand, it's like good news. The good news might be there might be a fewer of them in total. But the bad news is there may be the storms that will be strong make it a bit more intense.
That prediction is now mostly accepted by local scientists for the waters around Australia too. Savin Chand from the Federation University Australia has been reviewing the data about cyclones that have hit our shores.
There is a consensus now that overall the cyclone numbers may be decreasing, and this is consistent with tropical cyclone model experiments in the future. And some studies have sort of showed that the intensity of tropical cyclones will also go up.
But despite that consensus, there's still a lot of unknowns.
Tropical cyclones and climate change has always been a very hot topic. The main problem with tropical cyclone research is the satellites came into operation since 1960s, 1970s, which scientifically is not enough to do climate change detection and attribution studies.
Savin Chan says that could see the number of cyclones forming near Australia halve in number. In just the last year, a paper out of the University of Melbourne also found that the places where cyclones form around Australia could drift slightly further south. That's got climate change scientist Joelle Gerger calling for communities along Australia's coastline to start planning for worse storms in future.
We start to see these tropical cyclones drifting further south, then we start to see impacts in areas which aren't really prepared or designed in terms of their infrastructure to cope with those types of conditions.
But like many things in the realm of cyclone science, that's up for debate. Another expert, Kevin Torrey from the Bureau of Meteorology, says his research about what wind speeds or shear will do under climate change could stop cyclones moving further south.
Any tropical cyclone that's trying to form will actually be torn apart. We don't really know what's going to actually happen.
Kevin Torrey from the Bureau of Meteorology, Amelia Turzon reporting. I'm Linda Mottram and that's PM. Find us on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. Do not forget to subscribe and leave us a review while you're there. See you later.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.